was like none his men had ever seen before, and there were horrors lurking amongst the broken palaces and shattered statues of drowned Verlus, half a league north of the point where the fleet lay at anchor. The last time Victorian had spent a night ashore, his dreams had been dark and disturbing, and when he woke, his mouth was full of blood. The maester said he had bitten his own tongue in his sleep, but he took it for a sign from the drowned guard, a warning that if he lingered here too long, he would choke on his own blood. On the day the doom came to Valeria, it was said a wall of water 300 feet high had descended on the island, drowning hundreds of thousands of men, women, and children, leaving none to tell the tale but some fisherfolk who had been at sea and a handful of Velossi spearmen, posted in a stout stone tower on the island's highest hill, who had seen the hills and valleys beneath them turn into a raging sea. Fair Velus, with its palaces of cedar and pink marble, had vanished in a heartbeat. On the north end of the island, the ancient brick walls and stepped pyramids of the slaver port, Guzai, had suffered the same fate. "So many drowned men. The drowned guard will be strong there," Victorian had thought when he chose the island for the three parts of his fleet to join up again. He was no priest, though. What if he had gotten it backwards? Perhaps the drowned guard had destroyed the island in his wrath. His brother Aaron might have known, but the damp hair was back on the Iron Islands preaching against the crow's eye and his rule. "No godless man may sit the sea-stone chair." Yet the captains and kings had cried for Euron at the king's moot, choosing him above Victorian and other godly men. The morning sun was shining off the water in ripples of light too bright to look upon. Victorian's head had begun to pound, though whether from the sun, his hand, or the doubts that troubled him, he could not say. He made his way below to his cabin, where the air was cool and dim. The dusky woman knew what he wanted, without his even asking. As he eased himself into his chair, she took a soft damp cloth from the basin and laid it across his brow. "Good," he said, "good. And now the hand." The dusky woman made no reply. Euron had sliced her tongue out before giving her to him. Victorian did not doubt that the crow's eye had bedded her as well. That was his brother's way. "Euron's gifts are poisoned," the captain had reminded himself, the day the dusky woman came aboard. "I want none of his leavings." He had decided then that he would slit her throat and toss her in the sea, a blood sacrifice to the drowned god. Somehow, though, he'd never quite gotten around to it. They had come a long way since. Victorian could talk to the dusky woman. She never attempted to talk back. "Grief is the last," he told her, as she eased his glove off. "The rest are lost, or late, or sunk." He grimaced as the woman slid the point of her knife beneath the soiled linen wound about his shield hand. "Some will say I should not have split the fleet. Fools! 99 ships we had. A cumbersome beast to shepherd across the seas to the far end of the world. If I'd kept them together, the faster ships would have been held hostage to the slowest. And where to find provisions for so many mouths? No port wants so many warships in their waters. The storms would have scattered us in any case, like leaves strewn across the summer sea." Instead, he had broken the great fleet into squadrons and sent each by a different route to Slaver's Bay. The swiftest ships he gave to Red Ralph Stonehouse to sail the Corsair's Road along the northern coast of Sothorius. The dead cities, rotting on that fervid, sweltering shore, were best avoided, every seaman knew. But in the mud and blood towns of the Basilisk Isles, teeming with escaped slaves, slavers, skinners, whores, hunters, brindled men, and worse, there were always provisions to be had for men who were not afraid to pay the iron price. The larger, heavier, slower ships made for Lys, to sell the captives taken on the shields, the women and children of Lord Hewitt's town and other islands, along with such men who decided they would sooner yield than die. Victorin had only contempt for such weaklings. Even so, the selling left a foul taste in his mouth. Taking a man as thrall, or a woman as a salt wife, that was right and proper. But men were not goats or fowl to be bought and sold for gold. He was glad to leave the selling to Ralph the Limper, who would use the coin to load his big ships with provisions for the long, slow middle passage east. His own ships crept along the shores of the disputed lands to take on food and wine and fresh water at Valentis before swinging south around Valyria. That was the most common way east, and the one most heavily trafficked, with prizes for the taking, and small islands where they could shelter during storms, make repairs, and renew their stores if need be. 450 ships is too few, he told the dusky woman. But I can wait no longer. The only way. He grunted as she peeled the bandage off, tearing off a crust of scab as well. The flesh beneath was green and black, where the sword had sliced him. The only way to do this is to take the slavers unawares, as once I did at Lannisport, sweep in from the sea and smash them, then take the girl and race for home before the Valentines descend upon us. Victorian was no craven, but no more was he a fool. He could not defeat 300 ships with 54. She'll be my wife, and you will be her maid. A maid without a tongue could never let slip any secrets. He might have said more, but that was when the maester came, rapping at the cabin door, as timid as a mouse. "Enter!" Victorian called out. "And bar the door. You know why you're here?" "Lord Captain." The maester looked like a mouse as well, with his grey robes and little brown moustachio. "Does he think that makes him look more manly?" Kirwan was his name. He was very young, 22, maybe. "May I see your hand?" he asked. A fool's question. Maesters had their uses, but Victorian had nothing but contempt for this Kirwan, with his smooth pink cheeks, soft hands and brown curls. He looked more girlish than most girls. When first he came aboard the Iron Victory, he had a smirky little smile, too. But one night off the Stepstones, he had smiled at the wrong man, and Burton Humble had knocked out 4 of his teeth. Not long after that, Kirwan had come creeping to the captain to complain that 4 of the crew had dragged him below decks and used him as a woman. "Here is how you put an end to that," Victorian had told him, slamming a dagger down on the table between them. Kirwan took the blade, too afraid to refuse it, the captain judged, but he had never used it. "My hand is here," Victorian said. "Look all you like." Maester Kirwan went down to one knee, the better to inspect the wound. He even sniffed at it like a dog. "I will need to let out the pus again. The colour, Lord Captain, the cut is not healing. It may be that I will need to take your hand." They had talked of this before. "If you take my hand, I will kill you. But first I will tie you over the rail and make the crew a gift of your arse. Now get on with it."
"There will be pain."
"Always."
"Life is pain, you fool. There is no joy but in the drowned guard's watery halls.
Do it."
The boy, it was hard to think of one so soft and pink as a man, laid the edge of the dagger across the captain's palm and slashed. The pus that burst forth was thick and yellow as sour milk. The dusky woman wrinkled her nose at the smell. The maester gagged, and even Victorian himself felt his stomach churn.
"Cut deeper. Get it all. Show me the blood."
Maester Kirwan pressed the dagger deep. This time it hurt. But blood welled up as well as pus, blood so dark that it looked black in the lantern light. Blood was good. Victorian grunted in approval. He sat there unflinching as the maester dabbed and squeezed and cleaned the pus away with squares of soft cloth boiled in vinegar. By the time he'd finished, the clean water in his basin had become a scummy soup. The sight alone would sicken any man. "Take that filth and go."
Victorian nodded at the dusky woman.
"She can bind me up." Even after the boy had fled, the stink remained. Of late there was no escaping it. The maester had suggested that the wound might best be drained up on deck amidst fresh air and sunlight, but Victorian forbade it. This was not something that his crew could see. They were half a world away from home, too far to let them see that their iron captain had begun to rust. His left hand still throbbed, a dull pain, but persistent. When he closed his hand into a fist, it sharpened, as if a knife was stabbing up his arm. "Not a knife, a longsword. A longsword in the hand of a ghost." Sari, that had been his name, a knight and heir to Southshield. "I killed him, but he stabs at me from beyond the grave, from the hot heart of whatever hell I sent him to. He thrusts his steel into my hand and twists." Victorian remembered the fight as if it had been yesterday. His shield had been in shards, hanging useless from his arm, so when Ceres' longsword came flashing down, he had reached up and caught it. The stripling had been stronger than he looked. His blade bit through the lobstered steel of the captain's gauntlet and the padded glove beneath into the meat of his palm. "A scratch from a little kitten," Victorian told himself afterwards. He had washed the cut, poured some boiled vinegar over it, bound it up, and thought little more of it, trusting that the pain would fade and the hand heal itself in time. Instead, the wound had festered, until Victorian began to wonder whether Ceres' blade had been poisoned. Why else would the cut refuse to heal? The thought made him rage. No true man killed with poison. At Moat Cailin, the bug devils had loosed poison arrows at his men, but that was to be expected from such degraded creatures. Ceri had been a knight, high-born. Poison was for cravens, women, and Dornish men. "If not Ceri, who?" he asked the dusky woman. "Could that mouse of a maester be doing this? Maesters know spells and other tricks. He might be using one to poison me, hoping I will let him cut my hand off." The more he thought on it, the more likely it seemed. "The crow's eye gave him to me, wretched creature that he is." Euron had taken Kerwin off Greenshield, where he had been in service to Lord Chester, tending his ravens and teaching his children, or perhaps the other way around. And how the mouse had squealed when one of Euron's mutes delivered him abroad the iron victory, dragging him along by the convenient chain about his neck. "If this is his revenge, he wrongs me. It was Euron who insisted he be taken, to keep him from making mischief with his birds." His brother had given him 3 cages of ravens, too, so Kerwin could send back word of their voyaging, but Victorian had forbidden him to loose them. "Let the crow's eye stew and wonder." The dusky woman was binding his hand with fresh linen, wrapping it 6 times around his palm, when Longwater Pike came pounding at the cabin door to tell him that the captain of Grief had come aboard with a prisoner. "Says he's brought us a wizard, captain. Says he fished him from the sea." A wizard? Could the drowned god have sent a gift to him? Here, on the far side of the world? His brother Aaron would have known. But Aaron had seen the majesty of the drowned god's watery halls below the sea before being returned to life. Victorian had a healthy fear of his god, as all men should, but put his faith in steel. He flexed his wounded hand, grimacing, then pulled his glove on and rose. Show me this wizard.
Greaves' master awaited them on deck. A small man, as hairy as he was homely. He was a spar by birth. His men called him the Vole.
Lord Captain, he said, when Victorian appeared, this is Makaro, a gift to us from the drowned god.
The wizard was a monster of a man, as tall as Victorian himself and twice as wide, with a belly like a boulder and a tangle of bone-white hair that grew about his face like a lion's mane. His skin was black, not the nut-brown of the summer islanders on their swan ships, nor the red-brown of the Dothraki horse lords, nor the charcoal and earth colour of the dusky woman's skin, but black, blacker than coal, blacker than jet, blacker than a raven's wing. Burned, Victorian thought, like a man who has been roasted in the flames until his flesh chars and crisps and falls smoking from his bones. The fires that had charred him still danced across his cheeks and forehead, where his eyes peered out from amongst a mask of frozen flames.
Slave tattoos, the captain knew, marks of evil.
We found him clinging to a broken spar, said the Vole. He was 10 days in the water after his ship went down.
If he were 10 days in the water, he'd be dead, or mad from drinking seawater.
Salt water was holy. Aaron Dampier and other priests might bless men with it and swallow a mouthful or two from time to time to strengthen their faith, but no mortal man could drink of the deep sea for days at a time and hope to live.
"You claim to be a sorcerer?" Victorian asked the prisoner.
"No, Captain,"
the black man answered in the common tongue. His voice was so deep it seemed to come from the bottom of the sea.
"I am but a humble slave of R'hllor, the Lord of Light."
R'hllor, a red priest, then?
Victorian had seen such men in foreign cities, tending their sacred fires. Those had worn rich red robes of silken and velvet and lamb's wool. This one was dressed in faded, salt-stained rags that clung to his thick legs and hung about his torso in tatters. But when the captain peered at the rags more closely, it did appear as if they might once have been red.
"A pink priest," Victorian announced.
"A demon priest," said Wolf One Ear. He spat. "Might be his robes caught fire, so he jumped overboard to put them out," suggested Longwater Pike, to general laughter.
Even the monkeys were amused. They chattered overhead, and one flung down a handful of his own shit to spatter on the boards. Victorian Greyjoy mistrusted laughter. The sound of it always left him with the uneasy feeling that he was the butt of some jape he did not understand. Euron Crowseye had oft made mock of him when they were boys. So had Aaron, before he had become the Dampier. Their mockery oft came disguised as praise, and sometimes Victorian had not even realized he was being mocked. Not until he heard the laughter. Then came the anger, boiling up in the back of his throat, until he was like to choke upon the taste. That was how he felt about the monkeys. Their antics never brought so much as a smile to the captain's face, though his crew would roar and hoot and whistle.
"Send him down to the drowned god before he brings a curse upon us," urged Burton Humble.
"A ship gone down, and only him clinging to the wreckage," said Wolf One Ear. "Where's the crew? Did he call down demons to devour them? What happened to this ship?"
"A storm."
Makaro crossed his arms against his chest. He did not appear frightened, though all around him men were calling for his death. Even the monkeys did not seem to like this wizard. They leapt from line to line overhead, screaming. Victorian was uncertain. He came out of the sea. Why would the drowned guard cast him up, unless he meant for us to find him? His brother Euron had his pet wizards. Perhaps the drowned god meant for Victorian to have one too.
"Why do you say
"This man is a wizard," he asked of all. "Arcione, a ragged red priest."
"I thought the same, Lord Captain. But he knows things. He knew that we made for Slaver's Bay before any man could tell him. And he knew you would be here, off this island."
The small man hesitated.
"Lord Captain, he told me you would surely die, unless we brought him to you."
"That I would die?" Victorian snorted.
"Cut his throat and throw him in the sea," he was about to say, until the throb of pain in his bared hand went stabbing up his arm almost to the elbow. The agony so intense that his words turned to bile in his throat. He stumbled and seized the rail to keep from falling.
"The sorcerer's cursed, the captain," a voice said. Other men took up the cry. "Cut his throat, kill him, before he calls his demons down on us."
Longwater Pike was the first to draw his dirk.
"No," Victorian bellowed. "Stand back, all of you. Pike, put up your steel. Vol, back to your ship. Humble, take the wizard to my cabin. The rest of you, about your duties."
For half a heartbeat, he was not certain they would obey. They stood about muttering, half with blades to hand, each looking to the others for resolve. Monkey shit rained down around them all. Splat, splat, splat. No one moved, until Victorian seized the sorcerer by the arm and pulled him to the hatchway. As he opened the door to the captain's cabin, the dusky woman turned toward him, silent and smiling. But when she saw the red priest at his side, her lips drew back from her teeth, and she hissed in sudden fury, like a snake. Victorian gave her the back of his good hand and knocked her to the deck. "Be quiet, woman! Wine for both of us!" He turned to the black man. "Did the Vol speak true? You saw my death?"
"That and more."
"Where? When? Will I die in battle?"
His good hand opened and closed.
"If you lie to me, I will split your head open like a melon and let the monkeys eat your brains."
"Your death is with us now, my lord. Give me your hand."
"My hand? What do you know of my hand?"
"I have seen you in the night fires, Victorian Greyjoy. You come striding through the flames, stern and fierce, your great axe dripping blood, blind to the tentacles that grasp at your wrist and neck and ankle, the black strings that make you dance."
"Dance?" Victorian bristled. "Your night fires lie. I was not made for dancing, and I'm no man's puppet."
He yanked off his glove and shoved his bad hand at the priest's face.
"Here, is this what you wanted?"
The new linen was already discolored by blood and pus.
"He had a rose on his shield, the man who gave this to me. I scratched my hand on a thorn."
"Even smallest scratch can prove mortal, Lord Captain. But if you will allow me, I will heal this. I will need a blade. Silver would be best, but iron will serve. A brazier as well. I must needs light a fire. There will be pain, terrible pain, such as you have never known. But when we are done, your hand will be returned to you."
"They're all the same, these magic men. The mouse warned me of pain as well. I am ironborn, priest. I laugh at pain. You will have what you require, but if you fail, and my hand is not healed, I will cut your throat myself and give you to the sea."
Makoro bowed, his dark eyes shining.
"So be it."
The Iron Captain was not seen again that day, but as the hours passed, the crew of his Iron Victory reported hearing the sound of wild laughter coming from the captain's cabin. Laughter deep and dark and mad, and when Longwater Pike and Wolf One Eye tried the cabin door, they found it barred. Later, singing was heard, a strange, high, wailing song.
in a tongue the maester said was High Valyrian. That was when the monkeys left the ship, screeching as they leapt into the water. Come sunset, as the sea turned black as ink, and the swollen sun tinted the sky a deep and bloody red, Victorian came back on deck. He was naked from the waist up, his left arm blood to the elbow. As his crew gathered, whispering and trading glances, he raised a charred and blackened hand. Wisps of dark smoke rose from his fingers as he pointed at the maester.
That one, cut his throat and throw him in the sea, and the winds will favour us all the way to Meereen.
Macaro had seen that in his fires. He had seen the wench wed too. But what of it? She would not be the first woman Victorian Greyjoy had made a widow. Tyrion. The healer entered the tent, murmuring pleasantries. But one sniff of the foul air and a glance at Yezan Zokurgas put an end to that.
The pale mare, the man told Sweets.
What a surprise, Tyrion thought.
Who could have guessed, aside from any man with a nose and me with half a one?
Yezan was burning with fever, squirming fitfully in a pool of his own excrement. His shit had turned to brown slime, streaked with blood, and it fell to Yellow and Penny to wipe his yellow bottom clean. Even with assistance, their master could not lift his own weight. It took all his failing strength to roll onto one side.
"My arts will not avail here," the healer announced. "The noble Yezan's life is in the hands of the gods. Keep him cool if you can. Some say that helps. Bring him water."
Those afflicted by the pale mare were always thirsty, drinking gallons between their shits.
"Clean fresh water, as much as he will drink." "Not river water," said Sweets. "By no means." And with that the healer fled.
"We need to flee as well," thought Tyrion.
He was a slave in a golden collar, with little bells that tinkled cheerfully with every step he took.
"One of Yezan's special treasures, an honour indistinguishable from a death warrant."
Yezan Zokagas liked to keep his darlings close, so it had fallen to Yellow and Penny and Sweets and his other treasures to attend him when he grew sick.
Poor old Yezan! The Lord of Suet was not so bad as masters went.
Sweets had been right about that. Serving at his nightly banquets, Tyrion had soon learned that Yezan stood foremost amongst those Yunkish lords who favoured honouring the peace with Meereen. Most of the others were only biding their time, waiting for the armies of Volantis to arrive. A few wanted to assault the city immediately, lest the Volantines rob them of their glory and the best part of the plunder. Yezan would have no part of that. Nor would he consent to returning Meereen's hostages by way of Trebuchet, as the sellsword Bloodbeard had proposed. But much and more can change in 2 days. 2 days ago, Nurse had been hale and healthy. 2 days ago, Yezan had not heard the pale mare's ghostly hoofbeats. 2 days ago, the fleets of old Valentis had been 2 days farther off. And now?
"Is Yezan going to die?" Penny asked, in that please-say-it-is-not-so voice of hers. "We're all going to die. Of the flux, I meant."
Sweets gave them both a desperate look.
"Yezan must not die."
The hermaphrodite stroked the brow of their gargantuan master, pushing back his sweat-damp hair. The Yunkishman moaned, and another flood of brown water gushed down his legs. His bedding was stained and stinking, but they had no way to move him.
"Some masters free their slaves when they die," said Penny.
Sweets tittered. It was a ghastly sound.
"Only favourites. They free them from the woes of the world,
to accompany their beloved masters to the grave and serve him in the afterlife.
Sweet should know. His will be the first throat slit.
The goat boy spoke up.
The Silver Queen is dead, insisted Sweet. Forget her. The dragon took her across the river. She's drowned in that Dothraki sea.
You can't drown in grass, the goat boy said.
If we were free, said Penny, we could find the queen, or go search for her at least.
You on your dog, and me on my sow, chasing a dragon across the Dothraki sea?
Tyrion stretched his scar to keep from laughing.
This particular dragon has already evinced a fondness for roast pork, and roast dwarf is twice as tasty.
It was just a wish, said Penny wistfully. We could sail away. There are ships again, now that the war is over.
Is it?
Tyrion was inclined to doubt that. Parchments had been signed, but wars were not fought on parchments.
We could sail to Carth, Penny went on. The streets are paved with jade there, my brother always said. The city walls are one of the wonders of the world. When we perform in Carth, gold and silver will rain down on us, you'll see.
Some of those ships out on the bay are Carthine, Tyrion reminded her. Lomas Lung's trader saw the walls of Carth. His book suffice for me. I have gone as far east as I intend to go.
Sweets dabbed at Yezen's fevered face with a damp cloth.
Yezen must live, or we all die with him. The pale mare does not carry off every rider. The master will recover.
That was a bald-faced lie. It would be a wonder if Yezen lived another day. The Lord of Suet was already dying from whatever hideous disease he had brought back from Sothorius, it seemed, to Tyrion. This would just hasten his end. A mercy, really, but not the sort the dwarf craved for himself.
The healer says he needs fresh water. We will see to that.
That is good of you.
Sweet sounded numb. It was more than just fear of having her throat cut. Alone among Yezan's treasures, she actually seemed fond of their immense master.
Penny, come with me.
Tyrion opened the tent flap and ushered her out into the heat of a Meereenese morning. The air was muggy and oppressive, yet still a welcome relief from the miasma of sweat, shit, and sickness that filled the inside of Yezan's palatial pavilion.
Water will help the master, Penny said. That's what the healer said. It must be so. Sweet, fresh water.
Sweet, fresh water didn't help nurse.
Oh, poor old nurse. Yezan's soldiers had tossed him onto the corpse wagon last night at dusk. Another victim of the pale mare. When men are dying every hour, no one looks too hard at one more dead man, especially one as well despised as nurse. Yezan's other slaves had refused to go near the overseer once the cramps began, so it was left to Tyrion to keep him warm and bring him drinks. Watered wine and lemon sweet and some nice hot dugtail soup, with slivers of mushroom in the broth.
Drink it down, nursey. That shit water squirting from your ass needs to be replaced.
The last word nurse ever said was, no. The last words he ever heard were,
a Lannister always pays his debts.
Tyrion had kept the truth of that from Penny, but she needed to understand how things stood with her master. If Yezan lives to see the sunrise, I'll be stunned. She clutched his arm.
What would happen to us?
He has heirs, nephews.
Four such had come with Yezan from Yunkai to command his slave soldiers. One was dead, slain by Targaryen sellswords during a sortie. The other three would divide the yellow enormity slaves among them, like as not. Whether any of the nephews shared Yezan's fondness for cripples, freaks, and grotesques was far less certain.
One of them may inherit us, or we could end up
back on the auction block.
No, her eyes got big. Not that, please.
It is not a prospect I relish either.
A few yards away, six of Yezan's slave soldiers were squatting in the dust, throwing the bones and passing a wineskin from hand to hand. One was their sergeant called Scar, a black-tempered brute, with a head as smooth as stone and the shoulders of an ox.
Clever as an ox, too, Tyrion recalled. He waddled towards them.
Scar, he barked out, the noble Yezan has need of fresh, clean water. Take two men and bring back as many pails as you can carry. And be quick about it.
The soldiers broke off their game. Scar rose to his feet, brow beetling.
What did you say, dwarf? Who do you think you are?
You know who I am. Yellow. One of our lord's treasures. Now do as I told you.
The soldiers laughed.
Go on, Scar, one mocked. And be quick about it. Yezan's monkey gave you a command.
You do not tell soldiers what to do, Scar said.
Soldiers?
Tyrion affected puzzlement.
Slaves is what I see. You wear a collar round your neck, the same as me.
The savage backhand blow Scar dealt him knocked him to the ground and broke his lip.
Yezan's collar, not yours.
Tyrion wiped the blood from his split lip with the back of his hand. When he tried to rise, one leg went out from under him, and he stumbled back onto his knees. He needed Penny's help to regain his feet.
Sweet said the master must have water, he said in his best whine.
Sweets can go fuck himself. He's made for it. We don't take commands from that freak neither.
No, thought Tyrion. Even amongst slaves, there were lords and peasants, as he had been quick to learn. The hermaphrodite had long been the master's special pet, indulged and favoured, and the noble Yezan's other slaves hated him for it. The soldiers were accustomed to taking their commands from their masters and their overseer, but Nurse was dead, and Yezan too sick to name a successor. As for the three nephews, those brave free men had remembered urgent business elsewhere at the first sound of the pale mare's hooves.
The water, said Tyrion, cringing. Not river water, the healer said. Clean, fresh well water.
Scar grunted.
You go for it, and be quick about it.
Us?
Tyrion exchanged a hopeless glance with Penny.
Water's heavy. We're not so strong as you. Can we take the mule cart?
Take your legs.
We'll need to make a dozen trips.
Make 100 trips. It's no shit to me.
Just the two of us. We won't be able to carry all the water that the master needs.
Take your bear, suggested Scar. Fetching water is about all that one is good for.
Tyrion backed away.
As you say, master.
Scar grinned.
Masters, oh, he like that. Margot, bring the keys. You fill the pails and come right back, dwarf. You know what happens to slaves who try to escape.
Bring the pails,
Tyrion told Penny. He went off with the man Morgo to fetch Sir Jorah Mormont from his cage. The knight had not adapted well to bondage. When called upon to play the bear and carry off the maiden fair, he had been sullen and uncooperative, shuffling lifelessly through his paces when he deigned to take part in their mummery at all. Though he had not attempted escape, nor offered violence to his captors, he would ignore their commands oft as not, or reply with muttered curses. None of this had amused Nurse, who made his displeasure clear by confining Mormont in an iron cage and having him beaten every evening as the sun sank into Slaver's Bay. The knight absorbed the beating silently. The only sounds were the muttered curses of the slaves who beat him, and the dull thuds of their clubs pounding against Sir Jorah's bruised and battered flesh.
The man is a shell, Tyrion thought,
the first time he saw the big knight beaten.
I should have held my tongue and let Tsarina have him. It might have been a kinder fate than this.
Mormont emerged from the cramped confines of the cage, bent and squinting, with both eyes blackened and his back crusty with dried blood. His face was so bruised and swollen that he hardly looked human. He was naked, except for a breech clout, a filthy bit of yellow rag.
"You're to help them carry water," Morgo told him.
Sir Jorah's only reply was a sullen stare. "Some man would sooner die free than live a slave, I suppose." Tyrion was not stricken with that affliction himself, thankfully. But if Mormont murdered Morgo, the other slaves might not draw that distinction. "Come," he said, before the knight did something brave and stupid. He waddled off and hoped Mormont would follow. The guards were good for once. Mormont followed. 2 pairs for Penny, 2 for Tyrion, and 4 for Ser Jorah, 2 in either hand. The nearest well was south and west of the Harridan, so they set off in that direction, the bells on their collars ringing merrily with every step. No one paid them any mind. They were just slaves fetching water for their master. Wearing a collar conferred certain advantages, particularly a gilded collar inscribed with the name of Yezen Zokagas. The chime of those little bells proclaimed their value to anyone with ears. A slave was only as important as his master. Yezen was the richest man in the Yellow City and had brought 600 slave soldiers to the war, even if he did look like a monstrous yellow slug and smell of piss. Their colours gave them leave to go anywhere they might wish, within the camp. "Until Yezen dies." The Clanker lords had their slave soldiers drilling in the nearest field. The clatter of the chains that bound them made a harsh, metallic music as they marched across the sand in lockstep and formed up with their long spears. Elsewhere, teams of slaves were raising ramps of stone and sand beneath their mangonels and scorpions, angling them upwards at the sky, the better to defend the camp should the black dragon return. It made the dwarf smile to see them sweating and cursing as they wrestled the heavy machines onto the inclines. Crossbows were much in evidence as well. Every other man seemed to be clutching one, with a quiver full of bolts hanging from his hip. If anyone had thought to ask him, Tyrion could have told them not to bother, unless one of those long iron scorpion bolts chanced to find an eye. The Queen's pet Munster was not like to be brought down by such toys.
"Dragons are not so easy to kill as that. Tickle him with these, and you'll only make him angry."
The eyes were where a dragon was most vulnerable. The eyes and the brain behind them. Not the underbelly, as certain old tales would have it. The scales there were just as tough as those along a dragon's back and flanks. And not down the gullet, either. That was madness. These would-be dragon slayers might as well try to quench a fire with a spear thrust. "Death comes out of the dragon's mouth," Septon Barth had written in his On Natural History. But death does not go in that way. Farther on, 2 legions from Newgis were facing off shield wall to shield wall, while sergeants in iron half-helms with horsehair crests screamed commands in their own incomprehensible dialect. To the naked eye, the Gascari looked more formidable than the Yunkish slave soldiers. But Tyrion nursed doubts. The legionnaires might be armed and organized in the same manner as Unsullied, but the eunuchs knew no other life, whereas the Gascari were free citizens who served for 3-year terms. The line at the well stretched back a quarter mile. There were only a handful of wells within a day's march of Meereen, so the wait was always long. Most of the Yunkish host drew their drinking water from the Skahazadan, which Tyrion had known was a very bad idea even before the healer's warning. The clever ones took care to stay upstream of the latrines.
but they were still downstream of the city. The fact that there were any good wells at all within a day's march of the city only went to prove that Daenerys Targaryen was still an innocent where siegecraft was concerned. She should have poisoned every well. Then all the Yunkishmen would be drinking from the river. See how long their siege lasts then. That was what his lord father would have done. Tyrion did not doubt. Every time they shuffled forward another place, the bells on their collars tinkled brightly.
Such a happy sound. It makes me want to scoop out someone's eyeballs with a spoon.
By now Griff and Duck and Holden Halfmaester should be in Westeros with their young prince.
I should be with them, but no, I had to have a whore. Ken's saying was not enough. I needed cunt and wine to seal my ruin. And here I am on the wrong side of the world, wearing a slave collar, with little golden bells to announce my coming. If I dance just right, maybe I can ring the reins of Castlemere.
There was no better place to hear the latest news and rumours than around the well.
I know what I saw,
an old slave in a rusted iron collar was saying, as Tyrion and Penny shuffled along in the queue.
And I saw that dragon ripping off arms and legs, tearing men in half, burning them down to ash and bones. People started running, trying to get out of that pit. But I come to see a show, and by all the gods of Gis, I saw one. I was up in the purple, so I didn't think the dragon was like to trouble me.
The queen climbed up onto the dragon's back and flew away,
insisted a tall brown woman.
She tried, said the old man, but she couldn't hold on. The crossbows wounded the dragon, and the queen was struck right between her sweet pink teats, I hear. That was when she fell. She died in the gutter, crushed beneath the wagon's wheels. I know a girl who knows a man who saw her die.
In this company, silence was the better part of wisdom. But Tyrion could not help himself.
No corpse was found, he said.
The old man frowned.
What would you know about it?
They were there, said the brown woman. It's them, the jousting dwarfs, the ones who tilted for the queen.
The old man squinted down, as if seeing him and Penny for the first time.
You're the ones who rode the pigs.
Our notoriety precedes us.
Tyrion sketched a courtly bow and refrained from pointing out that one of the pigs was actually a dog.
The sow I ride is actually my sister. We have the same nose. Could you tell? A wizard cast a spell on her, but if you give her a big wet kiss, she will turn into a beautiful woman. The pity is, once you get to know her, you'll want to kiss her again to turn her back.
Laughter erupted all around them. Even the old man joined in.
You saw her then, said the red-headed boy behind them. You saw the queen. Is she as beautiful as they say?
I saw a slender girl with silvery hair wrapped in a toka, he might have told them.
Her face was veiled, and I never got close enough for a good look. I was riding on a pig.
Daenerys Targaryen had been seated in the owner's box beside her Gascari king, but Tyrion's eyes had been drawn to the knight in the white and gold armour behind her. Though his features were concealed, the dwarf would have known Barristan Selmy anywhere.
Illidio was right about that much, at least, he remembered thinking. Will Selmy know me, though? And what will he do if he does?
He had almost revealed himself then and there, but something stopped him. Caution, cowardice, instinct, call it what you will. He could not imagine Barristan the Bold greeting him with anything but hostility. Selmy had never approved of Jaime's presence in his precious king's guard. Before the rebellion, the old knight thought him too young and untried. Afterward, he had been known to say that the Kingslayer should exchange that white cloak for a black one, and his own crimes were worse. Jaime had killed a madman. Tyrion had put a quarrel
through the groin of his own sire, a man Sir Barristan had known and served for years. He might have chanced it all the same. But then Penny had landed a blow on his shield, and the moment was gone, never to return.
"The Queen watched us tilt," Penny was telling the other slaves in line. "But that was the only time we saw her."
"You must have seen the dragon," said the old man.
"Would that we had."
The guards have not even vouchsafed him that much. As Daenerys Targaryen was taking wing, Nurse had been clapping irons round their ankles to make certain they would not attempt escape on their way back to their master. If the overseer had only taken his leave after delivering them to the abattoir, or fled with the rest of the slavers when the dragon descended from the sky, the two dwarfs might have strolled away free.
Or run away, more like, a little bell's a jingle.
"Was there a dragon?" Tyrion said, with a shrug.
"All I know is that no dead queens were found."
The old man was not convinced.
"Oh, they found corpses by the hundred. They dragged them inside the pit and burned them, though half was crisp already. Might be they didn't know her, burned and bloody and crushed. Might be they did, but decided to say elsewise, to keep your slaves quiet."
"Us slaves," said the brown woman. "You wear a colour too."
"Gazdor's colour," the old man boasted. "Known him since we was born. I'm almost like a brother to him. Slaves like you, sweepings out of Astapor and Yunkai, you whine about being free. But I wouldn't give the Dragon Queen my collar if she offered to suck my cock for it. Man as the right master, that's better."
Tyrion did not dispute him. The most insidious thing about bondage was how easy it was to grow accustomed to it. The life of most slaves was not all that different from the life of a serving man at Castle Rock, it seemed to him. True, some slave owners and their overseers were brutal and cruel, but the same was true of some Westerosi lords and their stewards and bailiffs. Most of the Yunkai treated their chattels decently enough, so long as they did their jobs and caused no trouble. And this old man, in his rusted collar, with his fierce loyalty to Lord Wobblecheeks, his owner, was not at all atypical.
"Gazdor the Great-Hearted," Tyrion said sweetly. "Our master Yezan has often spoken of his wits."
What Yezan had actually said was on the order of, "I have more wits in the left cheek of my ass than Gazdor and his brothers have between them." He thought it prudent to omit the actual words. Midday had come and gone before he and Penny reached the well, where a scrawny one-legged slave was drawing water. He squinted at them suspiciously.
"Nurse always comes for Yezan's water, with four men and a mule cart."
He dropped the bucket down the well once more. There was a soft splash. The one-legged man let the bucket fill, then began to draw it upwards. His arms were sunburnt and peeling, scrawny to look at, but all muscle. "The mule died," said Tyrion. "So did Nurse, poor man. And now Yezan himself has mounted the pale mare, and six of his soldiers have the shits, may I have two pails full."
"As you like."
That was the end of idle talk.
"Is that hoofbeats you hear?"
The lie about the soldiers got old one leg, moving much more quickly. They started back, each of the dwarfs carrying two brimful pails of sweet water, and Ser Jorah with two pails in each hand. The day was growing hotter, the air as thick and wet as damp wool, and the pail seemed to grow heavier with every step. A long walk on short legs. Water slushed from his pails with every stride, splashing round his legs, whilst his bells played a marching song. "Had I known it would come to this, father, I might have let you live." Half a mile east, a dark plume of smoke was rising where a tent had been set afire. "Burning last night's dead."
"This way," Tyrion said, jerking his head to the right. Penny gave him a puzzled look.
"That's not how we came."
"We don't want to breathe that smoke. It's full of malign humours." It was not a lie. Not entirely. Penny was soon puffing, struggling with the weight of her pails.
"I need to rest."
"As you wish." Tyrion set the pails of water on the ground, grateful for the halt. His legs were cramping badly, so he found himself a likely rock and sat on it to rub his thighs.
"I could do that for you,"
offered Penny. "I know where the nuts are." As fond as he had grown of the girl, it still made him uncomfortable when she touched him. He turned to Ser Jorah. "A few more beatings, and you'll be uglier than I am, Mormont. Tell me, is there any fight left in you?" The big knight raised two blackened eyes and looked at him as he might look at a bug.
"Enough to crack your neck, imp."
"Good." Tyrion picked up his pails. "This way, then." Penny wrinkled her brow.
"No, it's to the left," she pointed. "That's the Harridan there."
"And that's the Wicked Sister." Tyrion nodded in the other direction. "Trust me," he said. "My way is quicker." He set off, his bells jingling. Penny would follow, he knew. Sometimes he envied the girl all her pretty little dreams. She reminded him of Sansa Stark, the child bride he had wed and lost. Despite the horrors Penny had suffered, she remained somehow trusting. "She should know better. She is older than Sansa, and she's a dwarf. She acts as if she has forgotten that, as if she were highborn and fair to look upon, instead of a slave in a grotesquerie." At night Tyrion would oft hear her praying.
"A waste of words. If there are gods to listen, they are monstrous gods who torment us for their sport. Who else would make a world like this, so full of bondage, blood, and pain? Who else would shape us as they have?" Sometimes he wanted to slap her, shake her, scream at her, anything to wake her from her dreams. "No one is going to save us," he wanted to scream at her. "The worst is yet to come." Yet somehow he could never say the words. Instead of giving her a good hard crack across that ugly face of hers to knock the blinders from her eyes, he would find himself squeezing her shoulder or giving her a hug. "Every touch a lie. I have paid her so much false coin that she half thinks she's rich." He had even kept the truth of Dasnak's pit from her. "Lions. They were going to set lions on us." It would have been exquisitely ironic, that. Perhaps he would have had time for a short, bitter chortle before being torn apart. No one ever told him the end that had been planned for them, not in so many words. But it had not been hard to puzzle out. Down beneath the bricks at Dasnak's pit, in the hidden world below the seats, the dark domain of the pit fighters and the serving men who tended to them, quick and dead, the cooks who fed them, the ironmongers who ironed them, the barber surgeons who bled them and shaved them and bound up their wounds, the whores who serviced them before and after fights, the corpse handlers who dragged the losers off the sands with chains and iron hooks. Nurse's face had given Tyrion his first inkling. After their show, he and Penny had returned to the torchlit vault where the fighters gathered before and after their matches. Some sat sharpening their weapons. Others sacrificed to queer gods or dulled their nerves with milk of the puppy before going out to die. Those who'd fought and won were dicing in a corner, laughing as only men who have just faced death and lived can laugh. Nurse was paying out some silver to a pitman on a lost wager when he spied Penny leading Crunch. The confusion in his eyes was gone in half a heartbeat, but not before Tyrion grasped what it meant. Nurse did not expect us back.
he had looked around at other faces. None of them expected us back. We were meant to die out there. The final piece fell into place when he overheard an animal trainer complaining loudly to the pit master.